This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've spoken many times on this program about the importance and value of eating locally grown foods, but nothing is more local than the food you produce yourself. Gardeners know this, but many people have shied away from starting their own vegetable gardens, despite the money they could save by growing their own produce and the benefits they would derive from the nutrition these freshly harvested items would provide. Some believe that it would just take too much time and effort. Others wouldn't know where to start. Our Johnson & Wales chef on assignment, Peter Reinhardt, has helped us bring together a group of people to tell you how to minimize your time and effort when it comes to vegetable gardening and can also help you get started. In addition to Peter, we're joined by Don Rosenberg, founder of Instant Organic Garden and co-author of the Organic Gardener's Cookbook and a book called No Green Thumb Required. Welcome back.
Thank you. Well, glad to be here.
Good. Dustin Adcock is a farmer and a local food specialist with the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service in Union County. Good to see you again as well.
Thank you very much.
And Megan Lambert is a chef, registered dietitian, and senior instructor at Johnson & Wales College of Culinary Arts and the co-author with Don Rosenberg of the Organic Gardener's Cookbook. And you, welcome, by the way.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And you brought some stuff from your garden?
I did. I brought some mustard greens from my garden to make salad for you. And I brought some beets, and I brought a nice Asian coleslaw. And
what kind of dressing did you bring with those mustard greens? What goes with mustard greens? I've never had a mustard green, I don't think.
Oh, lovely. You're going to enjoy it. This is a little lemon juice, garlic, black pepper, and Parmesan cheese, and a little olive oil.
Okay. And welcome, Peter.
Thank you. I'm getting hungry just looking at the salad and everything.
You brought
a little something from my garden.
My wife made this. But it's not pesto.
It's like pesto. It's sort of South American pesto, chimichurri sauce.
Yeah.
And it's got parsley and cilantro, some garlic, oil, garlic, lemon. Yeah. It's just you blend it up and it makes like a pesto-like sauce that goes great over pretty much everything.
Grilled vegetables.
We know that gardening is America's favorite hobby, but I'm wondering if we know how many people are growing flowers versus vegetables and fruits. I guess some people grow fruits.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know?
I'd say it's a small percentage, really. It's gaining quickly. It's one of the fastest growing, but from what I've seen, it's probably in about the 15 to 20% of gardeners are focusing on flowers. Flowers have tended to be a little bit of an afterthought.
Really? I would have thought the other way. So most people who are gardening to feed themselves.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends on what their first intent was. But when I think of a gardener, someone who intentionally went into the process, then they tend to go for the typical tomato, squash, cucumber, those kind of things, maybe some herbs. And the flowers are kind of tucked in around. We do have some people who, I guess, what I would say, plant and versus gardening. And those people might go to the flower first, but I kind of separate the two.
That's like landscaping and things like that, landscaped
exactly.
Shrubs and that kind of planting. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and there's not as many. I found there's just not as many of those that are what I would call an avid gardener. They're much more of a landscaper, maybe want a little bit of color, maybe want to do it once or twice a year and a little bit of maintenance. But
is it more difficult to be successful at growing your own produce than it is at growing petunias?
Well, both of them have their challenges. I think growing flowers is pretty easy because you basically just plunk them in and you don't have to worry about organic fertilizers and, you know, you don't have to water them as much. So, But gardening vegetables is a real challenge for today's families. In 1945, 45% of all produce consumed in the United States was grown in backyard gardens.
Wow.
And now it's more like 10 or 12%.
Well, this is part of the reason you're so hepped up on local and growing your own food, because we've lost our connection to our food, haven't we? As a chef and as somebody who's also a gardener, food today comes either through the drive-through window, or in plastic wrapped packages at the grocery store, that we have no idea where it really comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, a lot of the students that come to us at Johnson & Wales, they come and they have never seen how food grows or where it comes from. They may have an interest in it, but haven't really had that connection. And I think something to follow on to the fact that food is coming from the drive-in window and the box in the freezer section of the grocery store is the effect that it's had on our health as a nation.
Are you saying that that's what made us obese, or are you saying something else?
I'm saying that's probably part of it, the fact that we're eating processed foods that contain so much fat, salt, sugar.
But it's so much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so much easier.
How much more difficult is it to do something, to cook something nutritious, maybe using ingredients from your own backyard?
Yeah. I say it's really easy because things like roasted vegetables – delicious, really easy to do. You put a little olive oil on them, throw them in the oven, done.
For some people, it's easy if they know how to do it and they're confident in the kitchen. And for the others, that's why we have books like the one that Don and Megan just wrote to help them kind of overcome the hurdle and the fear.
You used to be in the music business, Don, and all that while I think you dabbled as a gardener and you became a master gardener, and somehow you transitioned from music. Well, I guess because everything went to MP3s and iTunes.
Yeah, when you can download a CD or you can burn a perfect copy of a CD on your computer, that kind of spells the end of the music business.
Time to hit the garden.
So you have experience as a full-time person concentrating on this, and you have experience as somebody who was involved in another business but still had your foot in the garden.
Definitely.
So how much time does it require for the average person? Because this holds people back. They don't want to get involved in being out there in the backyard every waking moment to keep the tomatoes from being ruined by the squirrels.
Right.
How do you do it?
Well, you know, that was actually quite a journey. It was about a 30-year journey. I moved to Charlotte about 32 years ago. We bought a house a couple of years later, and I was running the Record Exchange, which was my music stores, and I was working from my house. And I had a garden that had been there at the property, and so I started doing a garden just like everybody else has thought you're supposed to do a garden, which is, you know, getting out the tiller and grinding up the soil. And I was very clever. I got a compost, you know, from Compost Central, and you know, loaded up the truck and ground it all in, and it just turned into a nightmare. The traditional way of starting a garden with, you know, native soil and compost and fertilizer, it ends up bringing up, you know, hundreds of thousands of weed seeds. And every year I would grind it up again. It looked good, and then I'd add everything, and I would by the time the hot weather had come around, the weeds had taken over because I did not have the time or the interest in getting on my hands and knees and pulling weeds.
Mm-hmm.
So over that 30-year period, I started to try to find a way to make it easy to have a backyard garden in a small amount of space with as little work as possible, because I'm a guy and I'm lazy. I don't want to do any work that I don't have to. And so that's really what caused all of this was, okay, let's build raised beds. And instead of just, you know, putting new soil, you know, regular soil in raised beds, let's use new soil that's weedless. And that was the key, was the raised beds and then using the weedless soil and making a small garden really productive.
Dustin, you are, in addition to being an agricultural extension agent and a local foods expert for the North Carolina Agricultural Extension Service, you are a farmer and you're involved in a co-op, Farm Fresh Ventures Food Cooperative. Your role as a first of its kind local food expert is unique. Why did the state develop that role and give it to you?
Well, it kind of slowly evolved. We had horticulture agents, and those were designated as a local foods coordinator, and we got that once the agricultural department decided to start the 10% campaign. And the 10% campaign was where we basically said that Steve Troxler suggested that we spend $35 billion a year on food in North Carolina. And if we'd spend 10% of that on a local product, then we would generate $35 million to the local economy. So once we did that, they developed a local foods coordinator to try and kick that campaign off. That evolved into a lot of work that I think people didn't realize was going to come about. And with this whole movement of local foods, it became more than what a horticulture agent could do.
Now, we've had a conversation, you and I, about organic versus regular farming. Mm-hmm. I know that you and your farm practice organic practices.
Yes, sir.
But that organic farming is not the only way to go, and in fact, it's not possible to grow the kind of food that the world needs for the population. It's not possible to do it organically.
It's not. I have mixed feelings. I have an organic-based farm, and I'm very strongly supporter of organic growing methods. But I also have to realize from the research that's been done, we have to realize that we've got to be able to produce enough food, okay, in the next 20 years that will equate to all the amounts of food produced in the history of man. That's what the numbers are showing. And when we think about that, as much as we'd like to think of just the backyard and just the small producer, there has to be some use of our intelligence and our minds to find a middle ground. Because the truth is, research and science is not a bad thing. We have developed some good methods, just like in the medical field. There's lots of good methods, and then there's lots of bad things that go wrong. And that doesn't mean we shut our hospitals down because they have one thing that goes wrong.
And yet you've chosen to pursue the organic approach, as Don Rosenberg has, and you certainly embraced it as well, Megan. Why?
I chose that because I feel like when doing that, it gives me more opportunity to teach people. Mm-hmm. It gets their foot in the door. They're interested in a new system. And then I can educate them on why I'm not a certified organic farm, the differences in it. But most of the methods that are organic are really a traditional growing method. Most of the books are based off of knowledge that we had in the mid-1800s. It's nothing new. Most of what happened occurred to our traditional growing, and where it kind of went into this conventional mess that we have is in the 50s and 60s, when science became such a – we started pushing things out before we really thought things through.
I see.
Just in our space race and everything
else. Are we
still
doing that?
I believe so, but I think there's a lot more knowledge being put to our steps. The greatest thing we've done is no-till planting. The fact that we don't till soils in North Carolina anymore. Mm. We don't. The government stepped behind that. That's the reason the subsidies began, to try and make it affordable for a farmer to take on these new practices, to give them a little bit of bait to follow our new methods. And no-till soils have increased our production 20 and 30 times in the last 50 years. So it's, a good method.
So a lot of us have gravitated in the grocery store toward organic products when we can afford them, because they are more expensive than non-organically grown foods. And Megan, yeah, you're the dietitian here, in addition to being a chef and having co-written this book with Don, the Organic Gardener's Cookbook. What is it about organically grown foods that may or may not be better for us?
Well, the main thing is the fact that they're often grown without the use of pesticides, although there are some pesticides that are used in organic farming and gardening.
Do they not wash off when you wash the produce?
For the most part, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask a question to both of you, because you're growing organically, but some people use pesticides in their garden. And whether you grow organically or whether you spray with a pesticide, you're not going to just pick up a head of lettuce out of the garden and stick it in the salad bowl. You are going to
wash it. Yeah.
So, how do we wash?
Ah.
How do we wash produce?
This is a good one for me. I am really particular about making sure that my lettuce is really, really clean. I once had a...
Let me stop you there, because I've asked you a question you cannot answer in the time allotted.
Oh, dear.
So we'll come back on the other side of the break.
Yeah.
And we'll get it answered from Megan Lambert. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support this morning comes from WFAE members and Ginger Griffin Marketing, offering marketing and design solutions through logo and brand development, custom websites, and strategic advertising campaigns for over 15 years. Details at wehaveideas.com. Our guests today, Don Rosenberg and Megan Lambert, have shared some of their summer recipes from the Organic Gardener's Cookbook on our food blog, WFA Eats. You can find recipes for roasted corn salsa, buttermilk ranch dressing with fresh herbs, oven-fried okra, and more. That's at WFAEats.org. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, the 50th anniversary of desegregation efforts in Charlotte and how those efforts helped to inspire the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That's when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. And you can always listen online as well at WFAE.org. We're coming right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the acting chief of the IRS is forced to resign. President Obama goes on the offensive over political scandals, and the federal budget deficit is shrinking.
Join us for the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about growing foods in your own garden. We'll get to that in a couple of seconds. With Peter Reinhardt, our Johnson & Wales chef on assignment, Dustin Adcock, who's a farmer and the local food specialist with the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service in Union County and a part of the Farm Fresh Ventures Food Cooperative. Don Rosenberg is founder of... help me out here, Don.
Instant Organic Garden.
Yes, and the co-author with Megan Lambert, who's a chef and dietitian from Johnson & Wales, of the Organic Gardener's Cookbook. And I asked you a question about how we wash, whether it's organically grown produce or not. How do we wash?
Yeah, so washing to me is a big thing because, you know, people hate to have dirt in their salads or bugs in their salads, and you know that's just something that goes along with organic gardening is dirt and bugs.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really like to do is make sure that I take the lettuce and soak it in water. I have a big bowl of water. Wash the leaves really nicely. You can pull the leaves apart first thing and kind of get them in there and really swish them around so that you're getting a lot of the dirt off. And then I pull the leaves out, put them into a colander, and drain them. And then I look at the water. Is there a lot of dirt in the water? Then I dump out the water and get another bowl of water and wash the leaves again until there's, you know, very, very little dirt left in that water.
But it's, you know, see, it's one thing to wash dirt off. That's stuff we can see.
Right.
How does cold water and rinsing stuff in cold water get all the other stuff maybe that we can't see off these fruits and vegetables?
Mike, I want to chime in on what she's saying. One thing that's often overlooked is the fact that the food safety practices that are being pushed out now are telling farmers not to wash or pre-rinse produce before it goes to market.
Because?
Because what we found is that moisture, and in packaging, that moisture just creates a bacteria haven and was aiding in the passing of salmonella and things like that. Salmonella exists in our environment. A lot of people are scared to death of it, but it's just a natural bacteria in existence. And with that, we've learned that the less we can handle and wash it and leave that to the consumer, the better. And so I really want to preach that. Even at a farmer's market or at the farm, you really need to wash.
But Dustin, is water sufficient to get that salmonella off the leaves, or do you need to buy one of these, you know, like things, drops that you put in the water that breaks down toxins and things?
I really don't think that the drops are necessary. Most of what they're showing, if you do rinse on a farm, they're using a very, very small portion of chlorine in the water. Most of us, what we're finding is that if we wash thoroughly, we're pretty safe because the greens and stuff that's being used typically are not going to be fertilized with a natural fertilizer directly. We're using practices now that really protect that. Most of our manures and stuff that are used on the field are at least 6 and 8 months old. They've been broken down and composted.
Now, that's my next question, Don. In your book, No Green Thumb Required, you go into a great deal of detail about how to do raised bed gardening, organic gardening, on a very limited amount of space to grow a great deal of produce enough in the summertime at least, to feed your family. But even organic gardening must require some fertilizers, and I'm thinking that fertilizer might be manure or compost, and it's full of bacteria. So how do you protect yourself from that? Does it ever worry you? Have you ever had a problem with that? Should I be concerned?
Well, no.
You look healthy to me.
Yes, I'm pretty healthy right now. Now, first thing is you can garden all four seasons in Charlotte, and that's one of the true advantages of living in this part of the country, is that you've got four distinct seasons and you can garden in each one of them. A lot of people think of gardening as just the summer gardening with the tomatoes and peppers and squash and eggplants and beans and cucumbers, which you can garden all year long in the Charlotte area. And in terms of fertilizers, compost is not necessarily a fertilizer. It's a component of the soil, so that's not really a fertilizer. So you're going to be using organic fertilizers, brand names, Plant Tone is a good fertilizer. Worm castings is worm poop. And those are very, those are
thank you.
Fantastic.
Take a bite of salad.
Exactly. He's eating his breakfast here. And so that's they're all very, very safe. And so there's bacteria in absolutely everything we're around. And the human body is designed to cope with, normal.
Well, there's more bacteria on human skin and in our human anatomy than there are human cells.
Exactly, of course.
So I guess
most bacteria is actually a wonderful bacteria. It's what we use in farming. So, if given the chance, the good bacteria is far more aggressive and will survive much easier than the bad bacteria.
We're sitting here eating Megan Lambert's mustard green salad that came from her garden, and it has a very nice, fresh taste. And that, to me, is the importance of doing your own gardening, whether you do it organically or not. The nutritional value and the taste value of something coming out of the backyard moments before you eat it is dramatic, isn't it?
Absolutely. You can't compare, this from something you get out of a box. It's just not going to taste the same. And the fact that the nutritional quality is maintained, it's fresh as vegetables are stored and shipped and perhaps are not picked at the peak of ripeness, you're losing a lot of the nutritional value that you would get if something was just picked and just came out of the ground.
At the end of this month, May 29th, you, Don, are going to be working with Zio Restaurant Kitchen Garden, which is a new establishment, recently established, who are trying to grow 50% of their produce in their raised bed garden at their restaurant in Myers Park. They're doing this. Why do they want to do this?
Well, this is a really cool project I've been involved with Jim Consul at Zio. And first of all, they've got great food. And so he looked at his produce bill and he said, I'm spending a lot of money on this. And he wasn't really sure how it was being grown and how fresh it was. And so it turns out he has a lot of space around his restaurant that has really good sunlight. And so I actually work with him to design a garden. And we've got like 40 tomato plants planted and peppers and eggplants and squash and, and zucchini. And
so aside from his cost, because it will be cheaper for him to grow his own produce, one would think, than to buy it, does it, as from a chef's point of view, does it improve the flavor profile that much to make it worth the effort? Because obviously in restaurants you don't have farmers and you don't have gardeners. Somebody's going to have to take on an extra task to make this happen. Well, so does it improve the flavor profile? And does it, from a dietitian's point of view, does it really improve the nutritional value?
All right, well, let's talk about flavor for just a second. I have a friend who is a PhD in tomatoes, and he was actually studying what gives a homegrown tomato its flavor. And it turns out that there's alcohols and esters and all these kinds of volatile oils in tomatoes that give it its fantastic aroma and flavor. Mm-hmm. But they also, those same oils also break down the tomato very quickly. So when you have a homegrown tomato and it's ripe and you pick it and you put it on your counter, in 2 or 3 days, it's turned into mush. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what the farmers don't want. They want a tomato that is a red color and thick skin that will sit in that little plastic container for a week or two in the produce section, and it has no flavor, and it basically, it's going to have no flavor. It's going to have very little nutritional content. So being able to just grow your own tomatoes and enjoy that super rich flavor is going to be a tremendous advantage for them. And, having fresh produce from his own garden is going to be a tremendous plus for a restaurant.
And same would be true for a home gardener as well. But what about the nutrition? I know that when you pick a tomato or an ear of corn or a head of lettuce or some asparagus, whatever it may be, that it begins to lose nutritional value almost immediately. Mm-hmm. How quickly and how much?
Well, it depends a lot on the type of vegetable, the variety of the vegetable, how it's stored, all of those kinds of things. But, you know, you could lose up to 20, 30% of its nutritional value in a day, each day.
Really?
Yeah.
So it is a good idea to have your own garden. Go out in the backyard, pick it, wash it, eat it, or wash it, cook it, eat it, right?
Yeah,
yeah, certainly. And actually, the University of Illinois actually produced some information on, you know, why would we want a plant that maybe is grown in less of a commercial stance versus, you know, growing one in your backyard. And what they found is that produce and plants that are stressed a little bit in their growth actually create in their defense system more of these hormones and these contents that we take in, and they actually can help us fight cancer and heart disease and things like that. And they found that when we looked at things like blueberries and the antioxidants, that the plants that were grown in a more stressful environment, who actually had to fight some disease and fight some insect infestation, those plants had higher antioxidants. And so there's a big argument here to balance, because on the other hand, plants that are grown in that perfect commercial scenario also don't have to fight the disease as much, because we found that the weakest link is the one that gets attacked. So a plant that's suffering a little bit, the diseases, the insects tend to be a little more active towards.
So are you making then the argument that home gardeners who are not using all of these pesticides and growing in ideal conditions, et cetera, are actually doing themselves a favor?
They are. And even on the larger scale, when I talk to farmers and go and assess their growing practices, we're trying to start teaching people that there's a threshold of trying to prevent everything and growing something perfect, and allowing a threshold of where you're willing to accept some bug damage and you're willing to accept some disease and some water stress and not irrigating on a daily basis. So those things can, I think, can really be said to argue that homegrown product.
We've had a wet, cool spring for the most part. Does that make it good for gardeners? Has it thrown off the timetable, Don, for putting things in the ground? What impact has it had?
Well, first of all, you put in your summer garden starting on April 15th, mm-hmm. but you can put in a summer garden, start a summer garden as late as June 1st in this area.
Okay.
So this year, it seems like we're going to have to for some of us.
Exactly. And the nice thing about nature is that plants catch up. So if you had planted your spring garden on February 15th, like I told you, then your spring garden would be growing just like crazy right now, which is lettuces and peas and spinach and, carrots and broccoli and radishes and beets and so on. So your spring garden is doing fantastic. Normally what happens in the Carolinas is that around, May 15th, it gets really, really hot, and a lot of your cool season crops, start to fall apart. And so we're going to have a great, great fall harvest. And then in the summer, when it warms up, the plants just grow that much faster, and they're just happier. So we really don't miss a beat with weather changes.
One of the things that people who grow their own vegetables probably who are good at it and have some success, even those who are not terribly good at it, they notice that they have an abundance of tomatoes or squash that they just don't know what to do with. They can't get rid of it. They can't consume it. The neighbors are sick of them walking over with baskets full of squash. Please go away. We can't cook it either. So give me a rule of thumb. How many plants do you need to put in the ground of squash, of tomatoes, of whatever else people grow on average?
Well, I use the Goldilocks rule, which is not too much and not too little.
Be more specific.
So obviously it depends on the number of people in the family and how old they are. You know, if it's two adults and a two-year-old child, that's going to be totally different than two adults and a 15-year-old child. Mm-hmm. The rule of thumb for me, and I know Dustin disagrees a little bit, somebody said to me, well, how many squash plants do I need to feed one person? And I said, one. Well, how many do I need to feed two people? And I said, one. And the same thing goes for tomatoes, like cherry tomatoes. If you put in more than one cherry tomato plant in your garden, you're going to have so many cherry tomatoes, they're going to be on the ground and they're going to be sprouting next year, and it's going to be a mess. So I am, you know, two tomato plants, one cherry tomato, one squash, you know, two varieties of beans, you know, two varieties of cucumbers, et cetera. And a small garden is the key to this.
Okay. Which makes it easier.
Exactly. And we'll talk about that more.
And Don said, Dustin, you would disagree. So where do you disagree with that?
Well, I do a little bit. I wouldn't put all my eggs in one plant.
Because that's a mixed metaphor that I've ever heard.
It is. You know, you plant one squash, and if someone has a, let's say, especially in this area, we had the vine borer issue. So if they get a vine borer in the squash and it dies, then they might be really disappointed. And I always suggest that to take a natural, sustainable approach, always plant one for yourself and one for those others, meaning insect damage, rodents, whatever you might have an issue with. But let's make certain that we realize that in one perspective, we're talking about a Charlotte metro backyard, mm-hmm. and I'm dealing with often people who are calling me with 15 acres and they want to start growing a family garden. And so I'm talking people from an acre garden down to a quarter or tenth acre garden versus one raised bed. We're in two total different
universes.
Yes, exactly.
And you're talking about taking up how much space with a raised bed garden?
About 50 square feet will feed a family of four
so
for the next
that would be how
10
many,
years.
How many by how many feet?
Two beds that are 3 by 8 feet, one of them with a trellis, one of them not.
Okay.
And so what we're trying to do here in this discussion is we're really trying to help the people in the Charlotte area. And we've discussed how it's better to eat, you know, fresh produce and how much healthier that is for you. And my feeling is that if it's too much work or it takes too much room, people won't do it. Somebody said to me, Don, why don't you just grow a 50,000 square foot organic garden, you know, or farm and sell the produce? And I said, I would rather have 1,050 square foot gardens in backyards all over the Charlotte area. That's 1,000 people with a garden.
Yeah.
That's 2,500 children that grow up with a garden in their backyard, eating vegetables that were picked 2 to 8 minutes ago, not 2 to 8
First,
days
one of
ago.
The things we've talked about many times, Peter, is that the buying local and stressing local foods helps the local economy. But if you're growing it in your backyard, there's no money being spent, pretty much.
Well, you know, we have to sort of approach this almost as a consciousness raising exercise because there's so many different angles and aspects. Shopping at the local farmers markets is a way of helping support local farmers. If you're growing your own produce, are you going to buy as much? No, but most people are still going to want to buy some things that they can't grow themselves. So we kind of start to feel ourselves as part of a community, and I think that that's one of the benefits of this movement is that there's this community that's growing and we touch in with each other.
Speaking of local farmers markets, Megan does this every other Saturday in the summer. She's at the 7th Street Market, and she's appearing at Food Revolution Day at Discover You Museum in Mount Holly today from 4 to 7 p.m. And Don and Megan have shared some of their summer recipes from their Organic Gardener's Cookbook on our food blog, WFA Eats. You can find recipes for roasted corn salsa, buttermilk ranch dressing with fresh herbs, oven-fried okra, and more at WFAEats.org. We're going to come back and talk more about if you are successful at growing your own produce, what do you do with it? How do you cook it? What do you need? We'll do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes this morning from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting David Byrne and St. Vincent, trading verses and singing in unison, backed by an 8-piece horn section. June 18th in Belk Theater, tickets at 704-372-1000. Stick with us for the Diane Rehm Show coming up at 10 o'clock. It's the Friday News Roundup. The acting chief of the Internal Revenue Service is forced to resign. President Barack Obama goes on the offensive over political scandals, and the federal budget deficit is shrinking. A panel of journalists joins Diane for analysis of the week's top national news stories. That's the Friday News Roundup ahead on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. Stick with us.
The American Psychiatric Association is about to release the latest version of its diagnostic manual, and like all authors, they want it to sell.
Like in anything, the more the controversy is, the more curious people will be about the book, they'll buy the book.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. The true market value of the DSM. We'll have that and the latest news from Wall Street next time on Marketplace from APM.
Catch Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Peter Reinhardt, our chef on the sign from Johnson & Wales, is here with a colleague from Johnson & Wales, Megan Lambert, chef and registered dietitian and co-author of the Organic Gardener's Cookbook with Don Rosenberg, who is also here, and Dustin Adcock, a farmer and a local food specialist with the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Service. He tells me that Ask the Expert is available to all counties through the Cooperative Extension Service. What can you do when you ask the expert?
Well, it's great. You can go right in and type a question. You select a category that you think it falls under, and it goes to every extension agent in the nation. And we're basically based on how we answer and the things that we say that we're most specialized in, we get those questions bumped to us, and then we can answer it, and it funnels them down to the person who's best to answer it.
Can you do that with computers?
Yep. that would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah, the address is ces.ncsu.edu, ces.ncsu.edu, and we'll put that on our website here on WFAE.org. Wren on Facebook writes, I'd love to hear about maximizing small spaces with raised beds. How do you tier plants? Is my idea of planting lettuces under tomatoes, hoping to shade them and lengthen their growing time, going to work? I'd also like to hear about natural organic pest management. My little garden space is looking pretty good, but I feel like it's more of an exercise for me and my children and not something that's going to generate any substantial. You have talked in the past, Don, about where to plant certain things and why one of your raised beds is going to have a trellis and the other is not, and the orientation of those beds to the sun.
Well, number one, you put the tall stuff on the north side of your garden. Your garden should face south so that you have even sunlight. So think of your garden as stadium seating for vegetables. So as the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, it is washing over your garden equally, and the tall plants are not shading the little plants. So that's number one, is to do stadium seating. So that means that the trellis would be on the north side of the garden. And then the shorter plants would be on the south side of the garden.
So what about her question of shading the tomatoes with lettuce?
Well, shading the lettuce with tomatoes would probably be better.
Okay.
Yes.
Really?
And, you know,
big lettuce.
Lettuces are cool season crops.
Well, that's what she said. I read it correctly.
Yeah. Now, and interestingly enough, I work with seedsavers.org in Iowa, and they have – they're always looking for different kinds of varieties. And there are actually like four different varieties of lettuce that actually do well in the summer. Mm-hmm. So her idea is really a very good one. So you would have your tomatoes growing, and I remove the bottom 12 inches of branches from my tomatoes to get better air circulation. Mm-hmm. And that means you could be planting lettuce down below. Now, also, when you're planting lettuce, you're planting leaf lettuce, not head lettuce. And so you're going to be harvesting a leaf at a time from a mature plant, as opposed to growing a head of lettuce, waiting 84 days, and then chopping it off and having a hole in your garden. So her idea is very, very, you know, good, but she can be very, very productive in a small space.
Does that keep the lettuce, by picking the leaves off as it grows, keep it growing longer and prevent it from bolting to seed sooner? Or, you know,
actually, the thing that makes the lettuce bolt to seed is just the heat. Mm-hmm. And the variety. Mm-hmm. And so these are varieties that have different kinds of leaves that are thinner, and for some reason the plants don't seem to bolt, which is put up flower stalks and become bitter.
In this new book, The Organic Gardener's Cookbook, one of the things that you do, aside from talking about organic gardening and talking about recipes, is basic things that you need to know once you have this potential harvest out back. It would be no good at all if you didn't know how to cook it or what you actually have to have in the kitchen. So, are there quick and easy recipes for people who are used to opening the freezer and pulling something out, or going to the grocery store and getting a prepared dinner because they don't have time? Are there easy, quick ways to use this produce once you've grown it?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I mentioned before, roasting is one of my techniques that I use a lot. Almost any vegetable that you grow could be roasted. It's really quick and easy. All you do is put it into the oven and done 15 minutes later. Things like stir fries are really, really quick. And we talk a lot about the equipment that you need as well,
mm-hmm.
In order to make things fairly easy and quick, and give some basic techniques and knife skills so that the chopping and the preparing goes pretty easy. One of the things I love is a little plastic slicer that I use, and that just, especially if you're doing a stir fry, slices things up really, really quickly. So a lot about the preparation can go very quick, and it just takes a little bit of practice. You know, a lot of times people think it's drudgery, but when you learn how to chop that onion and you can do it very quickly, it becomes a lot less painful.
You are also aware, at least the book would indicate that you are aware of the time crunch that a lot of people
absolutely
face. And you suggest that you can make your produce into convenience foods by cooking large batches on the weekend when you may mm-hmm. have more time, and then doing what with it? Freeze it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do that a lot. I'm pretty busy myself. And so a lot of times I'll make a big batch of soup and I'll freeze it. I'll put it in like an individual size container or a bag. I should probably own stock in plastic bags. And then you just pull it out of the freezer every morning when you're ready to go to work. And
that doesn't defeat the purpose of growing your own produce and picking it off the vine and eating it 30 minutes later?
In one sense, yes. But on the other hand, you know, if we're just eating frozen processed meals that are really high in fat and sugar and salt, at least this way you can control those ingredients and make it a much healthier meal.
Now, you've brought several
really
things
much
today.
Tastier.
You brought the mustard green salad that we've all shared and I referred to earlier, but you also brought a coleslaw and you brought some beets, something that never passes my lips.
Oh.
But these passed my lips, and they're good.
Oh, thank you.
They are good, but the coleslaw is particularly tasty. It's kind of Asian.
Yeah, a little Asian slaw. And so, again, all we did was shred up the cabbage and the carrots. I have Napa cabbage and red cabbage and carrots. And that took about 5 minutes to shred it all up. And we have a lot more than this at home, too. it goes a long
but
way.
But the flavoring, where does that come?
The vinaigrette?
Yeah, how do you, because that's what's giving it
mm-hmm.
real
absolutely.
Zest.
The flavor's great, yeah.
Well, the recipe's in the cookbook, but it's a soy sauce, little bit of soy sauce, a little rice vinegar, mm-hmm. and olive oil, or you could use peanut oil as well. We used olive oil, though. Fresh ginger, which to me is one of the major flavors in Asian cooking, and then some sesame oil as a little flavor.
How do you know when to plant? I mean, how do you know when to put tomatoes in the ground, to put squash in the ground, asparagus, peas, whatever you're going to grow? How do you know?
Well, that's something we're really facing right now. I've had so many calls recently of people just saying, oh my gracious, you know, I had tomatoes a foot tall last year this time. One thing that's good to know about plants is that plants are only affected by time when it is during a growing, what we call a growing hour. Okay, and what we break it down is when that temperature is from that 60 to, say, 80 degrees, that's a really good growing temperature. Mm. When we drop below that, it's almost as though time stood still for the plant. So there's no reason to fret. Everyone's tomatoes, if you put them out this week, if you put them out next week, I guarantee you you'll have tomatoes basically at the same time. I strongly suggest people not to put transplants of squash in. Because squash from seed come up so quickly, they're better rooted, and all cucurbits, all vine crops, are poor transplants. In the commercial business, you'll never see them dropping in transplants of squash because it grows literally as fast as it transplants. So my suggestion is, you know, part of gardening, the fun of gardening, is learning to watch the environment and the weather.
Okay.
And when it's cool like this, you know, you have to kind of force yourself to hold back a little bit. I would say now is a good time to really start focusing on your tomatoes in your warm season. Mm. I think we're on the brink of getting our warm temperatures as we see today.
Yep.
And tomatoes can handle a little bit of a cold snap.
I talked to you, Dustin, and to you, Don. I don't know which one of you told me this. I was kind of surprised by your answer because I was going to ask you about the particular difficulties that gardeners face in this area with clay soils, and that hard red clay, it must be a horrible thing. On the contrary, one of you told me. I don't know which one told me this.
I think I had said that. Okay. Clay soils is actually, for a soil scientist, clay soils are one of the best soils we can have. The red coloring is from oxidation of the iron in the soil, mm-hmm. showing that we have water and air making its way down into the soil. It also holds nutrients longer than just about any soil. Even better than some potting mixes. It all depends on the crop. We have to think about where that crop is indigenous to. If it's a very warm season crop, then yeah, we have to take that into consideration. But there's nothing wrong with our soils in general.
But you advocate raised beds. So when you build a raised bed and plant your garden in it, are the roots going down to the clay or do they stop?
Well, the raised beds, most of the action is in the top 6 or 7 inches of soil. Mm-hmm. And if the raised beds are 10 inches or 12 inches deep, then they're fine. But they will grow, down further into the native soil. My problem with the clay is when you till it all up, you compact it even further, and you bring up those darn weed seeds.
Yeah.
And the weeding a garden is 2/3 of the work of a garden. If you can eliminate that mm-hmm. by buying new mixes that are weedless and using organic fertilizers, which stay in the soil until they're needed, that is definitely the way to go. Because what we're trying to do is make it easy for people to have a garden, and Megan wants to make it easy for them to cook what they just grew. So the goal is to make it easy so everybody does it, not just people with acres and acres of property.
Don, let me ask you a question about this weed issue. I've seen two proposed solutions in addition to just working with the soil. One is some kind of like a mulch cover, like I have an earth box, for instance, at home that where I can put this plastic cover, poke hole, and have my plant come up just through the hole itself, and then the cover prevents weeds from growing around it. And the other is just mulch in general, which seems to be like organic matter that suppresses weeds. Are those things you would recommend?
To me, those are average solutions. The best solution is to have soil that doesn't have weeds in it in the first
place.
And
aren't you making the soil monstrously hot if you got a plastic cover over it?
Well, there's just a whole bunch of reasons why having just regular soil. Now, you can use compost as a mulch in the summer to keep the water down, and it does keep the weeds down. Now, the wind is going to blow, and the birds are going to poop, and you're going to get
seeds blow around all
exactly.
the time.
Exactly. So, but you're going to get one weed per square foot, not 100. Mm-hmm. And so pulling a weed out of loose soil is, I can weed my garden in 30 seconds.
Now, I remember the commercials with James Whitmire. I think that was the actor who did the Miracle-Gro commercials. And he would walk around the garden and he would show these mammoth pieces of produce. And you'd think, yes, I'm going to buy some Miracle-Gro.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that?
Bigger is not always better.
Thank you, Megan.
And liquid fertilizer is not a brilliant, feat of man. We've been doing that for years. They were just smart enough to put a brand on it and start branding it. Liquid fertilizers used even in the compost world as a compost tea. And we found that it actually fights bacteria on leaves. It's a fungicide. It's a natural insecticide. For many insects. And, going back to the weed thing is, with using the fertilizers and using the soil, I want to make sure everybody realizes that, a weed is a plant growing somewhere you don't want it.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a bad plant. It could be something you had planted there last year that went to seed. And you have to stay on top of it. No matter what you do, you've got to stay on top of it. And the key is to be, proactive. And start with the first weed.
See, that's my theory about weeds in the lawn. It's green, leave it.
Some weeds do taste good. Some weeds are really
dandelions.
I mean, there are people who forage for edible weeds all the time. That's another kind of gardening in a way.
And most of our weeds were actually brought here.
Go ahead.
Now, Mike, you were talking about synthetic fertilizers, though, and Miracle-Gro.
Yeah.
Synthetic fertilizers, and this is what the science is now telling us, they act like an electric shock to a plant, and they cause it to grow unnaturally quickly. The plants are less healthy, and they're more susceptible to pests and diseases. So that's the main reason we want to be focusing. And they're salt-based, and they kill the life in the soil. So that's the main reason that I do not like to see.
Do they create, like, roid rage in plants?
Pretty much. It's unnaturally quick growth, and the salt-based fertilizers do kill life in the soil, and that's what makes plants healthy.
Is that why you say bigger is not necessarily better? Because this is America where bigger is always better.
Oh, no. I beg to differ. I think coming from a flavor and taste standpoint, you're getting this big, huge plant, but maybe not a concentrated flavor development there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want a little slight change on that. All nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium are salts. All of them, even in our organic compost. They're all salts. We have to monitor it no matter what. So to keep that in mind, even with compost, depending on what you're using and where the compost, manure, whatever you're using as part of your mix, they carry it. Even the compost that's pulled from leaf mulch, they carry with them. We're having a huge issue with copper due to the abundance of poultry litter and manure that's been used. We found that it's really high in copper. Now we have a toxicity in copper, even with a natural fertilizer.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a concern. I would argue that the science has proven that plants that grow and are growing well and are as healthy actually defend themselves quite well to insect and disease. I don't know if we'd say it's related to the fertilizer, but what we do find is that when we pile fertilizer on, just looking for that quick response, no matter if it is manure, no matter if it's a fertilizer, a commercial fertilizer, just in our grasses, we bring the roots up to the top of the soil. And in that case, we create a plant that's less rooted and less, I guess you'd say, resilient to heat stress, water stress, and then that can increase an issue with disease and pest.
I want to remind you that you can ask the expert, which is a nationwide website you can go to ask agricultural extension agents all over the country about your gardening questions, ces.ncsu.edu. You can also get Don Rosenbrook's book, No Green Thumb Required, which will tell you everything you need to know about starting raised bed organic gardens. And then what to do with all that food is found in the Organic Gardener's Cookbook, written by Megan Lambert, our guest here, and Don Rosenberg as well. Both of them have offered us recipes which we have put on our food blog, WFA Eats, at WFAEats.org. Megan appears tonight from 4 to 7 at the Discovery U Museum in Mount Holly, and every other Saturday at 7th Street Market. And with that, we have to say thank you for being here, because we are completely out of time. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.